av serier med Anton Bjuvald, Anders Lundgren och Fredrik Kaplan.
Hej och välkomna. Mitt namn är Anders Lundgren och jag är här med Fredrik Kaplan, och vi kommer ta resten av avsnittet på engelska eftersom vi har en väldigt speciell gäst med oss idag. Hello, Jim. I will do a little intro since I know you like that. Jim is a prolific cartoonist with a background in mini comics and scenes like the infamous Rambo 3.5 from way back in the day. You've done a lot of format experiments like Supermag, Cold Heat, with, you know, trying out different types of paper and whatnot to make your effects. And you also have the longer running series Street Angel with collaboration with Brian Maruca, as well as Aphrodisiac, The Plain Janes with Cecil Castellucci, American Virgin with Becky Cloonan, Octobriana, the world's first blacklight comic that we'll get back to, among other things. And of course, a lot of our listeners will know you from Cartoonist Kayfabe show. So thank you, Jim, for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Freddie, you had some initial questions now that we've delved a bit into the comics background of Jim.
Yeah, exactly. It would be great just to get to know, how did you get into comics? Because usually it's something you start with very young, but sometimes it comes later. And I know a popular thing in Sweden is like, oh, my parents had lots of comics, I discovered it through them, and so on. But how what's your comics origin story?
Yeah, I started, I like to draw. So I was drawing characters from movies and professional wrestlers, figure characters, and picked up a comic book when I was 10 or 11 years old, and that they looked kind of like my drawings. It was the same sort of characters and figures. And so as soon as I saw my first comic book, I just wanted to make comics. You know, it seemed like something I was already kind of doing before I realized, like, oh yes, comic books, you can get paid to do this. And once I bought my first comic book, that was my only real interest. Like I would move around, like, which comics I liked or which artist I followed, but I never wavered from comics. It was just comics, comics, comics.
And what was the comic?
It was a Marvel Comics Presents, which was like an anthology here in the States. Not a particularly good comic. You know, it was just, there was a Hulk story in it. I think Wolverine maybe. But it was, like I said, it was the comics form that really spoke to me and that I responded to. And then, you know, I was off and running, buying whatever comics I could find.
Lovely, lovely. Was that like the planting of the seed for the Hulk? We'll talk more about that later on, but yeah.
You know, I like the Hulk. And the other thing that happened when I started buying comics is the Hulk was gray instead of green. And I saw that, I would see that, you know, like in a bookstore, I would see the comic books and I would see this gray Hulk. And I just wondered, like, why does he look that way? And so I was interested in the Hulk even before I bought comics. You know, I knew the Hulk from cartoons and from comics and TV shows and things like that. So whenever I saw the gray Hulk, I wanted to know why he was gray, what was going on. And I started, I would pick up comics at the store and just kind of look at them and put them back. And then finally I bought one, and it was all, you know, that's what I've been doing ever since. But the Hulk was there in the first comic I bought.
Yeah. And also I heard that your intro to the Hulk was actually breakfast related. Do you still have that stuff? You can maybe tell us about that.
I don't still have that, but whenever I was six, I was in first grade. I had a Hulk bowl and cup set, and that's what I would, you know, drink orange juice out of my cup every morning and eat cereal out of the bowl every morning. And it had really cool Hulk drawings on it by John Romita. And I would look at those, and I loved monsters and dinosaurs. So, you know, going from, say, Godzilla to the Hulk, you know, on the side of my, my breakfast bowl, it kind of made sense. It was a monster. You know, I didn't know about superheroes or comic books, but I knew about these monsters you know, that I'd see in movies or in other books. And when I saw that Hulk bowl, it just looked like another monster to me. And the origin was on the back, you know, so I would be eating and just reading the origin over and over about how Bruce Banner would turn into this 1,000 pounds of unfettered fury, the mightiest mortal to walk the earth. And that just stuck. You know, I was six. It was before the internet. I didn't have a lot of stimulation. So no. that bull was that was the highlight of my morning for a year.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, that sort of stuff tends to stick with you. And I mean, here we are like 40 plus years later, and this is the week when Hulk Grand Design finally hits.
Yeah.
I'm so excited to have it out there. It takes so long to make these books, you know, and most of the time you're doing it by yourself and you're not supposed to talk about it.
No.
So finally I get to share it with readers. You know, the whole reason for making the book is to put it in people's hands, and this is the week.
Wow.
Yeah. That is beautiful. And it was originally 316, right? But I guess it's one of the, you know, paper shortages or pandemic related things that occurred, right?
You know, Marvel hasn't told me why they pushed back the release date, but I assume it was something with shipping, printing. There have been a lot of shortages that I'm aware of. You know, my partner on Cartoonist Kayfabe, Ed Piskor, his book was pushed back several months due to paper shortages or shipping issues. So it's something that's affected comic books for sure.
But do you still need that bowl? Maybe that's one of the like kayfabe effects for like your big gift for when the Grand Design book comes out, the big one.
One of the kayfabers sent me a message that they sent me the bowl. So I haven't gotten it yet, but I think there is one on the way.
Ah, yeah, beautiful. I knew it. Yeah, that's the love of the kayfabe community, right?
They're fantastic. And you can bet pictures of that bull will show up on my social media once I get it.
Awesome. Yeah, just excellent. Awesome. If we want to continue on talking about you and your start, I know you went to school. Did you study like design, graphic design stuff? Was that just because there weren't no like comic book education or what?
Yes, there were. Two schools I knew of that taught comic books, Joe Kubert School and the School of Visual Arts in New York. But the comic book market in America had tanked. Like Marvel, I think, declared bankruptcy in 1996. And I went to school in 1995. So, you know, what started out really strong in the early 90s just went away. And my taste had changed. You know, at the time, those big selling books were Marvel and then Image Comics. And by the time I went to school, I was bored with those. And I was looking at like Dan Clowes' 8-Ball, what we call called alternative comics. And Julie Doucette, who just won the grand prize at Angoulême, her comic Dirty Plot. That was the stuff I was looking at. And those books didn't sell like Marvel and Image Comics. They never sold like Marvel and Image Comics. You know, the idea was, maybe you make a little bit of money on those comics, but also you do something else for, you know, to pay your bills. And so that's why I went to school for graphic design, because I thought that's art related, but I can also get a job with that, you know, and pay the rent. So I didn't give it too much more thought at the time, but I look back on it and I think that graphic design was a great thing to study for comics, because it's the other art form that deals with images and words together.
Yeah,
you know, so it's almost a happy accident that I did that, but I think it's helped me a lot. And I went from, you know, going to school for graphic design to working in print production, which is the other piece that has helped me a lot. You know, I've self-published a lot of my comics. If I'm not self-publishing, I often do a lot of the design work myself. So having that background is very helpful for everything, you know, from doing a blacklight comic like Octobriana to doing the Hulk book collection. You know, I'm working on the design for that book collection now. So having that design background, I think, has been a real help for me.
Yeah, yeah. And you can tell by your books. I was looking through the Street Angel, the thin hardcover ones, and they're so oversized. You can see you've really handpicked every color, and all the designs are so, the minutiae is there, you know, they look great. really Thank great. You. So you can tell it's like this is made with love, and yeah, I wouldn't maybe not Chris Ware, but almost, you know, it's like that almost yeah, design mania.
I'm not sure anyone's Chris Ware when it comes to that level of detail, but yeah, it's a part of design, you know, getting those little things the way you want them.
And speaking of color, you really delved into that subject quite deeply. I've heard that you really studied comic book coloring, with going into the real nitty gritty of how to make, you know, the little dots yes. sort of connect yeah. with the reader and so on. Could you tell us a bit about your experiments in comic book coloring?
Yes. When I started making comics, I was like an independent creator, what we would call independent comics here in the US. And most of those comics were printed in black and white because it was too expensive to print in color throughout like the 80s and 90s. And then when digital, you know, like when digital production started, the price to make color comics decreased, and then independent creators could make color comics. And so I started to try to figure out, how do I make color comics? Because up to that point, all I did was work on the black and white part. And one of the first books I did in color was Aphrodisiac. And that's a book that's set, it's a period piece. It's set in the 1970s. And that's a time period I really liked the color of those comics. And I made that in the 2000s. And it was when computer coloring was becoming the norm in comics. And the problem with computer coloring is it's perfect. You know, everything is, if you have a gradation, you can make it completely smooth. If you have a flat color, it can be 100% consistent. And it looked funny. You know, like I was looking at these comic books and I didn't like the color and I wasn't sure why. So when I did Aphrodisiac, my idea was go back to old computer coloring and try to study why it looks the way it looks. And so I would scan comic book panels at very high resolutions, you know, where I'm looking at what's a panel this big in a comic book. I would blow it up to 27 inch, you know, like my 27 inch monitor and look at all the dots and try to figure this out. And they had a very simple system back then of like 64 colors to choose from because of the way they mixed colors in printing. And I started with that. And then after Aphrodisiac, I just kept expanding what I was trying. You know, I experimented with color and I just kept trying new things and looking at new examples. I like Jamie Hewlett, who did Tank Girl, and he would color sometimes with markers and had a very good color sense. Some artists would paint, you know, like on their artwork to get full color. And so I started looking at just more examples of color and just adding and trying new things with my work, because color is, I think it's the most powerful part of the comic in terms of what we see. You know, it's I don't know how to explain it. It's just very powerful. So I think it's important to have control over that and to, you know, explore that, but it's so complex. You could spend your whole life studying color and still just scratch the surface.
Yes. Yes, definitely. And I mean, it is a very powerful tool. Like you see when one of my favorite cartoonists, Mike Mignola, how he works with Dave Stewart mostly, he really knows how, you know, color can direct your attention, and when you save like the color red, which is an obvious one popping up in Hellboy, and you just use that for the main character and maybe one little detail in one sequence, then it's it really draws your eye in and gets your mind thinking about all the stuff that came before and whatnot.
Yeah, Mike Mignola is a great example for good color in comics for the reasons you say. You know, it's very thoughtful how he and Dave Stewart color those comics.
And speaking of more coloring, the Black Like Octobriana comic. How did you first get introduced to Octobriana? Because in my mind, she's a sort of obscure character. I first saw her adventures in sort of a roundabout way through Brian Talbot's Luther Arkwright, Adventures of Luther Arkwright. And what was your introduction to Octobriana? Because she's a Czech comic character.
There was a book that came out called Leather Nun and Other Strange Comics.
Yeah.
And it had maybe 50 different comic books of like weird characters, something weird, something strange. And I like that stuff. That's one of the things I love about comics is like kind of the weird history of comics. You know, anything goes in comics because they're they've been so cheap to produce that people make really strange things. And so this book highlighted a bunch of unusual comics, and Octobriana was in that book. And it sounded cool. You know, there was like a couple of pieces of art and a little bit of a description, and it looked good. So it comes from a book that was published in the UK in like 1970. And that's what this collection of strange comics pointed out, you know, the original book. And I tracked that book down, and that was, you know, really my source for Octobriana. But I knew Brian Talbot's use of the character in Luther Arkwright. So that was an interesting piece too. And then once I started looking around, I found that there were a handful of Octobriana comics out there that different people had, you know, had made over the years. But I think the Brian Talbot Luther Arkwright appearance is probably the biggest one. And I think it might be the first one outside of the original Octobriana book. I think Brian Talbot was the first person to put that character into, you know, into a real comic book.
And the Blacklight process, what drew you to that?
I was I make screen printed posters sometimes, yeah. And I made a screen printed poster years ago, and the someone had hired me to make it, and they said I could do whatever I wanted. I could have metallic ink or fluorescent ink, and I realized that fluorescent ink is what's used in blacklight. So I made a blacklight poster, and the process of making the poster, I thought this goes back to my design and print production. I thought you could make a comic book with this. You would just switch out certain inks and you'd use some of these fluorescent inks instead of like the conventional CMYK inks. And I work closely with Chris Pitzer from Ad House Books. He's a publisher and a designer and knows everything about print. So anytime I have an idea, he's usually the first person I go to and I say, do you think this would work? And he thought about it and he said yes, and that he would like to do it. You know, if I came up with a book, he'd be interested in it. So that was the beginning of it. And I think we came up with the idea at Angoulême a couple of years ago. We were standing around and talking, and I mentioned it to him. And then I had to come up with a story that would fit, you know, a blacklight idea. And so it took me about a year of doing other things, but just kind of thinking in the back of my mind, I need an idea for this. And I was looking at my Octobriana book, and it just felt right. It felt like, you know, this was a character. The story of Octobriana is that it's a Russian, like a countercultural movement in the USSR during the Cold War. And this book and some of the art got smuggled out from behind the Iron Curtain. And that's how we came to know Octobriana in the West.
Yeah.
Not true, but this is no. The story okay. That's around the character. And so I thought, this is great. I could imagine like the underground artists in America getting hold of this book and wanting to show solidarity with their counterparts in Russia. And so they would, you know, put together an American underground comic about Octobriana. And that made sense because I think of blacklight posters and blacklight art as being like 1970s culture here in America. And especially with the head shops where the underground comics were distributed and, you know, where you could buy them. So that was, you know, like when I started looking at Octobriana and thinking blacklight, it just kind of fit, like those two pieces came together, and then I was off and running. You know, I had my character that I was going to use, and you know, just started writing the story and then drew it, and next thing you know, we have a blacklight comic.
Yeah, beautiful. Getting back to the Hulk grand design, that was of course quite an undertaking. You've been delving into the history of the character, and from what I've heard, you have read the like 500 plus issues three times.
Yes,
something like that.
That's right.
That's intense.
Intense is a great word for it. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, and the other piece of it is it was during the pandemic, so like I was doing this kind of locked in my room for a year with just Hulk comics.
Okay.
So intense is a very good description. You know, I read the whole series and I would make notes, you know, after I would read each issue, I would just make notes so that I had some idea of what was happening in that issue, if it was something that I needed to put into the Hulk grand design. And then I kind of wrote a story around those notes. And whenever I would go back and actually start working on pages, I would reread the issues that were relevant to those pages. So they were always very close to me. And I'm still doing that. As I put together the book, for instance, I have a letters page that I'm putting together. And that meant going through all the letters pages. Ooh. So,
oh, wow.
yeah, it's I'm really dissecting that series, you know, to try to make a definitive book. If you only get one Hulk book, Hulk Grand Design will really give you probably the most comprehensive Hulk you can get in one book.
Wow.
Yeah, because I mean, it was a kind of a missed opportunity from Douglas Volk. He's got almost no Hulk in his all of the Marvels.
Well, see, it's perfect. You can read his book and you can supplement it with Hulk Grand Design.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's great. And your like entryway to the Hulk comics was the Gray Joe Fixit, and I think that very few of those comics were actually published in Sweden, because there's like Hulk has got a bit of a spotty history in Sweden. Always popular, of course, around the time of the TV show and everything. And could you tell us a bit about those storylines? What made you? Was it just the color, the coloring again, or what drew you to them?
Yeah. Once I started reading comics, you know, Hulk was a character that I knew. So I was interested in that. And he was different. So I had questions, you know, and it was like pretty natural to just start picking up those comics to try to figure out, why is he not green anymore? What's going on? And what I found was, this is Peter David was writing at that time, who wrote Hulk for 12 years, you know, probably the writer most associated with the Incredible Hulk. And he really did a lot of different things with Hulk. When I went back through to read, you know, like the whole series, what I found was the first 300 issues or so, Hulk doesn't really change. He's just this, a monster, you know, for lack of a better word. And then when Peter David shows up, he does all kinds of stuff to try different things with the character. And the Gray Hulk was one of the first things that he tried. So the Gray Hulk was smart, you know, which was different than the usual. The Green Hulk usually is kind of a big, dumb monster, but the Gray Hulk was smart. And he was kind of he was very unlikable, you know, he was not a good guy. He wasn't a hero. And that was intriguing. You know, most of the comics that I was picking up besides the Hulk were books like Spider-Man or X-Men, where the characters were heroes, and the Hulk really wasn't a hero. And definitely Mr. Fix-It, not a hero, you know, very okay. interesting character, but not that hero type character. And I really liked that, you know. Going back through the series, one of the things that stood out to me with the Hulk is you can line up like all the popular superhero characters, and they're kind of similar. They're good guys, you know, and they have a lot in common, but the Hulk isn't part of that group. You know, the Hulk really is this other type of character, which I think makes him super interesting, you know, especially within like the Marvel universe. And that Gray Hulk kept that part, even though he was different than the Green Hulk, he still wasn't some hero, you know. He was still kind of like this guy you would cross the street to avoid. If you saw him, you're probably in trouble. You know, he was scary, and he might have been scarier than the Green Hulk because he knew what he was doing. And I loved that part of the character. You know, I thought that was a really interesting take on Marvel's monster. You know, in some ways he was more scary, more dangerous as that gray version. And eventually, you know, at this point, I'm reading it, you know, month to month when it's being published. And eventually the Green Hulk comes back, you know, shortly after I start reading it. But I think it was a couple of years that the Gray Hulk existed. And it was cool. I would go and buy back issues, you know, to kind of get that story of what he was doing in the Joe Fixit era and all of that stuff. And it just, you know, I think being different was a huge part of what kept me interested in that character. You know, I checked it out because of childhood nostalgia. And then it was like, oh, this is really good. This is interesting. I want to know what happens next. And for a long time, I felt that way about, you know, the Peter David Hulk. So I was very, you know, it was probably my favorite comic for a while, watching what was going to happen next, because for me, it was all a surprise. You know, I didn't have a long history with comics. What happens with a lot of those comics you realize every couple of years they cycle through the same stories, the same storylines, yeah. the same bad guys come back. But your first time through, it's all new and fresh. And so, you know, the first time Grey Hulk fights the Thing, that was my first Hulk Thing battle. So it was just a good time to be a reader, you know, for me. And there's probably quite a few eras where you could have got on board and it would have been a good time. And I think that was one of them. There were a lot of, there was a good energy because I think Peter David was clicking. There were good artists, Todd McFarlane, Jeff Purvis, Del Keown, Sam Keith, you know, they all did Grey Hulk stories in that run. And I would follow artists more than I would follow characters. And so yeah. that was a big part too, you know, like the Hulk looked really good at that time period, in my opinion.
Now you have quite a few pages for your comics, of course, but how do you, it's not as much as 500 plus issues. So how did you go about the I guess, very hard process of, you know, picking out because what you will include and what you will not include and so on, because you, yeah.
That's exactly the process. You know, like I knew I had 80 pages total to work with. And so I made up a document, you know, where I would kind of write like my ideas out and break those into pages and see how many pages my ideas covered. And I would pick the ones that like, I have to have Hulk Wolverine, you know, I have to have Joe Fixit Hulk, you know, like there were these things that in my head had to be in there. And so I kind of came up with a number of those. And then I also was trying to figure out what's the big story overall, you know, what kind of runs through all of these issues and covers 60 years of this character's history. And so that was the other part that I was trying to juggle was like one big story that would make sense if you, you know, you read these 80 pages and you feel like this is a character that does develop and does kind of progress through the story. So yeah, it was a little bit of both of those things. One, knowing like there are certain things that have to be in there, big moments, important moments. Same thing with the artists, you know, I reference certain covers or certain visual moments, you know, that I think stand out. So that was kind of the process, you know, like really thinking what has to be in there and then trying to build the story around those parts.
Yeah. It's like important moments, like when he posed as a clown robot for those. Yeah, it was the Circus of Crime, right?
That's right. Yes.
Yeah, that's a very big moment for me. Where it wasn't enough that Hulk was kind of dressed up as a clown; it had to be a clown robot as well.
That's not the only clown robots, by the way.
Okay.
Because Rocket Raccoon is introduced at some point in the Hulk in the early 300s. They're fighting robot clowns from space.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I love Rocket Raccoon, of course. So yeah, that's you have a point there.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Mike Mignola artwork, by the mm-hmm. way.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're going through all this Hulk material, and we talked about them being like cyclical and things reappearing, did you just know this is like the worst part of the Hulk? Did you find something like, oh, I don't want this. This is just trash. Like the worst part.
Wow. Yeah, I don't want to throw anyone under the bus.
No.
No,
I have been critical of it. At one point, Peter David has a storyline where like the Hulk, the Gray Hulk, the Green Hulk, and Bruce Banner become one. And I call him Professor Hulk. Sometimes he'd wear glasses and stuff, and his hair would be combed, you know. So it was
a
neater version of the Hulk. And he did it. There was a storyline with a group called the Pantheon. It was like a group of other heroes that were kind of behind the scenes, but working to engineer, I don't know, peace in the world, you know, to improve the world. And it was, in a lot of ways, it's a very traditional hero version of the Hulk, you know. And to me, what makes the Hulk special is that he's not a traditional hero. And that storyline ran for something like 4 years. And it's in real time, that's when I quit reading the Hulk. I wanted a monster, and this guy wasn't a monster. He would lose fights routinely in this time. And again, like I think of like Hulk's power, Hulk smash, you know, he's the strongest. I didn't want to see him losing fights. You know, I didn't want to see him all cleaned up. And that storyline ran for a long time. So that's probably my least favorite parts of the Hulk, but I do I do keep that in. It's an important part of Hulk history, but it wasn't my favorite part, you know, as a reader. The other thing that's neat with reading this stuff, because I mean, 60 years, you know, the average age of the readers change. And I think who the creators are sort of making the comic for changes. And it was interesting to be able to read decades of comics over the course of a few weeks and see that change, you know, see the art gets more sophisticated or the thing gets more complex, but those early comics, you can see it's written for, I don't know, 7 year olds maybe. And reading like 20 of those at a time, they weren't made to be read that way. So that that would be interesting. There were nights when I would go to sleep and it was just like rub. It just felt like my eyes needed to be washed out, you know, after reading that stuff. But
no more Hulk smash.
Yes. Oh. But it was fun to see that progression. And you know, that was something that I tried to do in Hulk Grand Design, is to kind of show that evolution. You know, it's not just what happens in the comics, but also kind of like how the Hulk fits in the world historically. So, you know, I have references to things outside of the comic, but I also stylistically, I hope my storytelling changes over the course of the, Hulk Grand Design to kind of show like, it's very different 40 or 50 years into the Hulk run in terms of how he's presented to readers. So I try to have that in there in Hulk Grand Design as well.
Nice. That's very interesting. Wow.
Like a metafiction level of interaction between the rest of the world and the fictional world. It's interesting that I thought about, I don't know if you read Philip Jose Farmer, but he made a couple of biographies like that of Doc Savage and Tarzan.
I haven't read those, but that makes sense. That's kind of, you know, the way I was picturing this, and not just metaphysical, but also historical, you know? So like I thought of the Hulk comic books as a historical source. You know, if I'm doing a biography of the Hulk, this is a historical source, but also like the world at large. You know, my first interaction is not in a comic book. You know, my first interaction is on merchandising. So I want to represent that. You know, the Hulk TV show is probably somewhere that people first saw the Hulk. And now today it's Hulk movies and Hulk video games, you know, Avengers movies. Like people see these characters, they might never see a comic book, but everybody has heard of the Hulk. How does that work? Why, you know, how does that happen? And so I try to acknowledge some of those things too. You know, some of these big moments, like there's a great one in the early 1970s, the Hulk was on Rolling Stone magazine cover, drawn by Herb Trimpe, and he's like breaking the logo, and it's this really great piece that's in there, because to me that's awesome. That's the Hulk going beyond the comics, you know, like that's the Hulk now out in our world, like in our reality. And I find that stuff really interesting, you know, especially I look at the Hulk as, think of the big characters, the big fictional characters that come out of the 20th century. Hulk might be one of the 10 best known characters created in the 20th century. That's amazing, you know. And for me to get to play with a character of that magnitude, it's exciting, but I want to show that. I want to show that scope. You know, I want to kind of represent that, like, it starts in a comic book, but there's a lot more to the Hulk than just the comics.
And it's interesting with the, especially what you're saying now, that, I mean, the TV show was obviously Marvel's first really successful foray into motion pictures or TV. I mean, they even tried, as you know, to start like a Marvel TV universe, you might say, instead of cinematic universe, with you know, those backdoor pilots for Daredevil and Thor was in there for those TV movies in the late 80s.
Yeah, I used to record those on my VCR.
Yeah, of course.
There was also, you know, attempts at Spider-Man television shows. I think this,
but they never took off.
They didn't make it. Although there was one in Japan.
The Japanese one. I think they domestically over there it went quite well. But I mean, the other Spider-Man shows, there became two pilots, I think, or something like that. And as with Doctor Strange, but
The Japanese one. was very much adapted to the Japanese market at that time with the big fighting robots and stuff. Leopardon, I think it's called, like the spider mech that he summons. So okay. It's, yeah. So I think that helped in a way.
You had a great episode, you and Ed Piskor, about one other strange part of Hulk history, the Barry Windsor Smith story that we eventually got to read last year as Monsters. Have you talked to Barry Windsor Smith about that? Or
I've never spoken to Barry Windsor Smith. I would love to. I'm a huge fan of his work. I liked Monsters a lot. You know, Weapon X is one of my favorite comics that he wrote and drew and colored. So we do look at his work a lot on Cartoonist Kayfabe and talk about it a lot. Because I think, you know, again, looking at Marvel comics, like from a, you know, following an artist around, I think he's one of the best artists to ever work for Marvel. And so, you know, we do end up talking quite a bit about his work, and definitely an influence on me. I can remember when Weapon X came out, which was in Marvel Comics Presents, you know, many, many issues after the first one that I bought. But I can remember like trying to copy his art, you know, when I was trying to make comics, but trying to copy his art, because it was just, I never saw anything that looked like his work. And still I haven't, you know, like he's a cartoonist that's very singular in terms of his style. You know, I don't know that anybody can copy that, but it had a big impact on me. Like when I saw it, it didn't look like any other comic book artist that I knew.
No, those issues are like totally mind-blowing when you read them at the exact right age.
I was the right age for this.
Yeah. And I mean, still, I mean, you can look back at them and see different things now, of course, because my appreciation for Barry Windsor Smith has only increased over the years, like going back to his work. But what I'm getting at is that when you're like 14 and you see that stuff for the first time, then it's it changes you.
And for anybody listening that's not familiar with the backstory of Barry Windsor Smith's Monster, that started out as a Hulk idea. And then, you know, I'm not sure how it separates from Marvel and he goes off and does it himself. But originally, I think that was a concept he had for a Hulk story. And it would have dealt with Bruce Banner as a child, you know, being abused by his father. And for whatever reason, you know, it doesn't end up at Marvel, but then Barry Windsor Smith just keeps working on it for decades and becomes that big graphic novel that was released last year. But some of those ideas, Bill Mantlo picks up in the Incredible Hulk series, the idea that Bruce Banner was abused as a child by his father. And Peter David sort of builds on those whenever we start to see like different Hulks as reflection of different personalities within Bruce Banner. And, you know, like he associates those with childhood trauma.
And of course, it comes back in like one of my big reading experiences of the last couple of years, Immortal Hulk. It's an integral part of that. But your stop off for Grand Design is slightly earlier, as I recall, right? It's around the millennium.
Yes. Around the end of the first volume of Incredible Hulk. I can't remember the issue that it runs to, but maybe 400 and almost 500 issues of the first Incredible Hulk series. And then I do a little bit of stuff that happens after that. Like I reference Planet Hulk and World War Hulk, Hulk Future Imperfect, you know, so I go a little bit past the end of that series, but not as in depth with the last couple of decades.
Tell us a bit more about the you devote like one page to each like episode or event or thing from Hulk's past, and you filter the style through your own, I guess, and for when you're presenting it.
Yeah, it's, you know, I kind of approached it with like anything goes, whatever I could do to make each page exciting. I got interested in like Sunday newspaper comics from the early 20th century. And, you know, they've started reprinting all of these great comics that I never saw until maybe the last decade. And you read those things and the mistake, you know, I mentioned reading 20 issues of early Hulk comics. They're not really built to be read that way. It's the same with newspaper comics. You know, they're not really, they were done daily or weekly. And now we get compilations that have a couple of years of newspaper comics all at once. And it can be weird to sit down and read, like, this is 2 years of comics I just read tonight. You know, it can be kind of a strange experience. But I started looking at those Sunday newspaper pages, and they're amazing. You know, like they're foundational to the comics language. They're inventive. You know, a lot of that stuff, a lot of the things we see in comic books today were figured out by the Winsor McKays and, you know, the George Harrimans and these people early on making comics for the masses. And reading those like big pages, like, I find the best way to enjoy those is read a couple of them at a time, you know, and then take a break, because they're dense, they're full, they're kind of like visual overload. There's so much there. But whenever I started doing the Hulk, the challenge was, how do you take 10,000 pages and make it fit in 80 pages? And so I started thinking about those Sunday pages, and it was like Sunday pages and posters were big influences on how I approached this. And I would do one page at a time, and pretty much whatever I could come up with to make that page interesting and fit the story that was going on that page. And I drew this thing with, you know, pencils, color pencils, watercolor, traditional ink, markers, ballpoint pens, whatever I could come up with was fair game, because I just wanted each page to be like exciting, interesting, and communicate, you know, the ideas of, you know, that page. So yeah, it's a little bit of anything goes. If you follow my work, if you're listening to this and you're familiar with my work, sometimes I'm called like a style chameleon, because I do different styles and I work with different media. This is probably the big showcase of all of that, the culmination of all of my experimentation up to this point, in terms of just trying to tell this story the best way that I could. And, you know, living in this digital production age, we have access to a lot of tools, you know, a lot of different media, a lot of ways to present a story. And I was trying to use everything I could think of to, you know, to tell this story the best way I can.
Yeah. And I'm super excited to finally get to see it. And I got it on my pull list, of course. And I hope that a lot of our listeners have that as well. Support your local comic shop and support great comics. And you have a bunch of covers that were like incentives normally, but they're the same price. You know, Ed Piskor is doing his like Todd McFarlane interpretation.
Yeah, with the original, like the first appearance of Wolverine. Mm-hmm. That's a cool cover. Peach Momoko is doing one with She-Hulk.
Yeah.
Marcos Martin is doing one of the transformation, you know, like Banner turning into Hulk. That's really nice. Jeff Darrow did one that I'm super excited about because I got to color his. I'm a big Jeff Darrow fan, so that was quite an honor and a thrill. And Ed McGuinness, who has drawn some really great Hulks himself, is doing a cover. So, yeah, I'm excited that they're available, not as incentives, but anybody, you know, if one of those covers, you know, speaks to you, if that's one of your favorite artists, like, you just tell your comic shop that's the one you want, and they should be able to get it for you.
That's great. How did you manage that?
That's Marvel, you know. Yeah, good, definitely. Them, yeah. I would tell them ideas, but you know, it's up to them to what they ended up doing. So that's their choice.
Yeah, because it's always it can be a hassle to get those special covers otherwise. So that's very thankful for that. And speaking of She-Hulk, have Marvel contacted you about She-Hulk Grand Design? She has a TV series coming up, you know.
You know what? They have not, but who knows? If they're listening, I would love to at least do a She-Hulk cover or two.
Yeah. I'm guessing she's in the Grand Design, of course, but what's your take on She-Hulk as a character?
I'll tell you a really interesting piece of She-Hulk history. She-Hulk was created because of the way the Incredible Hulk television show and the rights to the Incredible Hulk television show were set up. Huh. What I believe happened is, I don't know, lawyers or somebody advised Marvel, but essentially they needed to create She-Hulk because if they didn't, the production company could. And then they would have owned She-Hulk as opposed to Marvel owning it. So it was something based on rights is the reason that they needed to, you know, create that trademark essentially. So kind of an interesting bit of history there.
Wow.
Yeah. It's funny how these things work, but you know, you think of She-Hulk through the years, it's turned out to be a really great character. But initially, I think it was done for legal reasons.
Well, yeah, but that's so interesting with the this whole back and forth goes through throughout comics history, where, you know, like you had a great episode of Cartoonist Kayfabe about Superman recently, and how the some of the ideas that we now are see as foundational were made up in different media, such as the the radio show and the serials, and how they rewrote the origin as they went along, just to kind of accommodate what people had heard or seen in the Fleischer cartoons or whatever.
Yeah, and I think that still happens today, you know, as these idea intellectual properties, as they go from one media to another, you know, they get reworked and reshaped and made to fit whatever that is, a TV show, a movie, a book, a video game. And sometimes, you know, it's a chance, maybe the comic book sometimes is a first draft. And then whenever it comes time for the TV show, it's a chance to maybe fix stuff that, you know, you've thought about over the years and thought it'd be better if this character was introduced in this other way, or, you know, if the relationship was a little bit different. So I think you're seeing more and more of that as, you know, as these characters kind of go through so many different versions. You know, it's a chance to, I don't want to say get it right, you know, I mean, they wouldn't be being adapted if they weren't successful, but they change, you know, over time they change. You know, you think about the Hulk 60 years of history, he's changed a lot in that time, you know, whether it's different writers, whether it's just seeing it, you know, through these different perspectives over time, and different perspectives in terms of new creators coming in and showing off what they see, you know, what their version of that character is, trying to make the best version each time.
What are your plans for the book version of Hulk Grand Design? Because it's 2 issues first, and then you're working on the book.
Yeah, if you've seen the other Grand Design books, they are like big, oversized Treasury editions. Mm-hmm. I will be that those books all reprint classic stories in the back. So I will be reprinting some comics. I don't want to say what yet, but I'm
okay.
Guess what comics are in there. Hopefully my editors approve of them. So I'll have a few comic reprints. I'm also, putting in some of the different pieces that inspired Grand Design. So like one of those in particular, Marvel Age was a comic I read when I was a kid, and it wasn't really a comic. It was comic book size, but it was kind of about whatever was going on at Marvel, interviews with creators, previews of new books. They would have a page every issue that said it was the many faces of, and it'd be a different character, you know, many faces of Wolverine, Captain America, and of course, Hulk. And I got hold of that whenever I was a kid. And what it was like 15 different versions of the Hulk by different artists, like who had actually drawn the Hulk, you know, like they were pulling out, like, here's the Jack Kirby version, here's Steve-O, you know, here's Todd McFarlane. And that was one of the early things I saw where it was like, oh, different artists draw these characters differently. And that really stood out to me, you know, and as I was already following artists, now it was like, oh, I want to see Todd McFarlane draw whatever character is my favorite character. Cause you know, he seems to do these wild different versions, or, you know, I need to go track down more Jack Kirby because I love the way this looks. But it really kind of spoke to me of, because I liked the Hulk at the time. So like seeing all these different versions, I wanted to track down back issues. I wanted to understand why he looked different at different times. You know, so that was a big early, that was an early seed of how I approached Grand Design. I didn't know it at the time. I just knew that's interesting that the Hulk has changed over, you know, at that time he might've been 20 years old or something, 25 maybe. And, but seeing all those different versions kind of, it made me understand comic books a little bit, at least like the Marvel DC kind of comic books where you would have different creators, you know, rolling through these characters. And that's something that I carry over into the Hulk Grand Design. So that's a page that I'm going to try to reprint or try to include in the book to kind of talk about like how seeing that and seeing these different versions of the Hulk really informed what I wanted to do with the Grand Design.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I hope we're also getting some process pages and whatnot.
Yeah, there'll be some. you know, I don't want to spoil anything, and none of it's been approved yet either. No? So who knows? There could be changes, but yes, I'm showing off, you know, certain original art that I made for the series. I'm trying to make the greatest Hulk book ever made. In fact, I'm trying to make the best comic book period for this year. And I'm pretty happy with it at this point. Like I'm down to the last half dozen pages out of, you know, 120 pages plus the covers and pages and things. I'm pretty far along in the process, and I'm thrilled with how it's coming along. So I'm excited to, you know, to just like the comics, I'm excited to share it with the readers out there and let, you know, find out what they think. But I'm aiming high with this, you know. Chip Kidd is an influence on me design wise, and being able to kind of go through like all of this Hulk history, I'm trying to pull out, you know, the greatest, coolest looking stuff I can find for end pages and for chapter breaks and things like that. So, you know, there's a lot to sift through. This morning before we got on here, I was looking for, there's an ad that I'm planning to reproduce in the back of the book. And the ad is for this thing called Hulk Up. And it was some kind of like system that you would like pump up, like you would wear this suit under your clothes and it was inflatable to give you muscles.
Okay. you're definitely speaking my language.
So I feel like that's some of the fun stuff that I don't want it to be lost to history. So I want to show off some of the stuff that I have found just in this last year, you know, really looking at Hulk.
I'm loving that.
Yes. It must be, you know, kept for posterity and republished. Yes. From what I've heard about your upcoming project is that you're really going back to the roots with your spiral bound sketch, more like sketchbook type of material.
Yeah, that's something that I've been working on for a while. You know, I'm known to draw with ballpoint pens. I draw with these kinds of like a kid's tool, really, and I draw with them on notebook paper. I've had a couple of art shows with those over the years, so I am planning to do another collection of them. You know, I think I have enough built up now to do another notebook, and it's a reproduction of my notebooks is what those, you know, what you're referring to, and I'm hoping to do that maybe later this year.
Hey,
great. But how was what was your reaction when you saw Emil Ferris? My favorite thing is Monsters, of course,
she's phenomenal. You would love her, but very cool to see that.
Yeah, because she also goes all the way with the ballpoint pen art.
Yeah, I love seeing it, and you know, from having shows with the ballpoint pen art, I get a lot of feedback from people who. They find it inspiring because like we've all used ballpoint pens, you know, and scribbled in notebooks and sat through class, you know, it's maybe been traumatized looking at that blue line paper, but, you know, I think people connect with that. So seeing Emil's book, it's one more piece of that kind of connection. And what she does is different than what I do. So it's kind of opened my eyes to some ideas too, as to like, oh yeah, you know, going in this or that direction is exciting. And it's cool to see like just using these materials, that, you know, I want everybody to draw, you know, I want everybody to think that if they want to make a comic, they can do it. And I think using these kinds of materials, it's very accessible. So it's great to see what she has done because I mean, that book is gorgeous, you know, and hopefully people see that and think, oh yeah, I have pens.
Yeah.
I could draw, you know, let me try to make my own drawings and my own comics with this stuff. You know, it doesn't have to be India ink and a sable hair brush, and that's pretty cool. When I was a kid, that was a big thing, like trying to figure out what tool do I use, how do I make a comic that looks like, you know, what a John Romita or something. And it felt like, you know, there was a little bit of a barrier there, just trying to figure out what tools to use. And I want people, you know, I don't want the tool to be a thing that keeps somebody from making art. You know, like we can use any tools we have, and that includes junk ballpoint pens and notebook paper. You know, if that's what you've got, look what can be done with that. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's the beauty of comics. I think that it's so the threshold is so low, and the accomplishments that can be made with those really simple tools, it's just mind-boggling when you think about it.
Yeah, I agree, and I hope that, you know, people people take that away from not just my work, but from comics in general. I mean, it's words and pictures, and those pictures don't have to be anatomically correct to have impact. You know, they you can say anything with between words and pictures. So I hope people, you know, I hope people see that whenever they see comics, if they have something they want to say.
You probably want to get back to the drawing board, even though, I mean, it's been wonderful talking to you. But just one little interesting tidbit is that, we started out this podcast in 2010. We're not entirely sure when Freddy, I think, was the came up with the
I think it was Anton.
Anton, okay. Yeah. Was Anton, yeah. The tagline, Läs mer serier, which is read more comics. And so it's, I mean, I'll chalk it up to, you know, great minds think alike, that cartoonist kayfabe has the same sort of like send off. How did you end up with that?
You know, we said it one time early on in cartoonist kayfabe.
Yeah.
We said it and realized like, yeah, keep saying that. That's the message we want out there.
Yeah.
It really sums up, you know, that's my feeling on this stuff, because when I started making comics around 2000, it was pretty bleak. You know, the prospects for being a cartoonist or, you know, having comics in front of a lot of a wide audience, it didn't look good then. And since then it's changed, you know, more and more people read comics now for a variety of reasons, but I love it. Whether it's comics in libraries, maybe the movies make some comic fans, manga, I think, has become a huge popular part of comics here in the States. All those things are great as far as I'm concerned. Like, read more comics is, I couldn't sum up my feelings any better. You know, I hope everybody does it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. And so best of luck with all your future endeavors. And I hope that you will come back to the show and maybe talk about when the Grand Design book is out or anything else you might like to discuss.
I would love to. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And will you do the honors, Jim?
Yes. Read more comics.